Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
What is cultural appropriation? Do we always know it when we see it? Is some appropriation more harmful than others? Is there a less harmful way to borrow culture without doing actual harm? When religious conviction, belief, or faith of some overlaps with a practice or action of others, where does the murkiness of harm begin? My guest on this episode to discuss these ethical questions is Dr. Elizabeth Bukar, and our topic is the book Stealing My Religion, Not Just Any Cultural Appropriation, out now from Harvard University Press. Stealing My Religion guides us through three revealing case studies: the hijab as feminist signal of Muslim allyship, a study abroad pilgrimage on the Camino de Santiago, and the commodification of yoga in the West. Dr. Liz Bukar is Director of Sacred Rites, Professor of Religion, and Dean's Leadership Fellow at Northeastern University. She is an expert in comparative religious ethics and is the author of three books, including the award-winning trade book Pious Fashion, How Muslim Women Dress from Harvard University Press in 2017. Bukar's public scholarship includes bylines at The Atlantic, Los Angeles Times, and Teen Vogue. You can follow her on Twitter at Bukar Liz, and you can follow me on Twitter at classical_ideas. Thank you so much for listening. Dr. Elizabeth Bukar, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Greg. Nice to be back again.
It's a delight to have you here. This is your third appearance, if you count the bonus episode that we recorded a couple of years ago at my house on your birthday. So welcome back again, and thank you for joining me for your third appearance with me. This is wonderful to have you. And I'm wondering if you could spend a moment and introduce yourself to the audience for those who may be hearing from you for the first time about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So my name is Liz Bukar. I'm a professor of religion at Northeastern University, and my research and writing focuses on religious difference and how we understand religious difference. It sort of changes the way we understand what is right and good in the world. That's sort of the theme that cuts across my work. I'm also director of a grant-funded project called Sacred Rites that helps support networks and scholars who want to, sort of talk about their research outside the academy and start and participate in conversations in the public.
Wonderful. You were here. It's been a while now, but pre-pandemic, I think it was just before the pandemic, we hung out and we talk about your other book, Pious Fashion, which was released in 2017, and then it was issued as a paperback in 2019. So, I'm always curious about the in-between times for people between books, and I would love to know kind of like what sorts of doors Pious Fashion opened up for you and how that book may have altered, if at all, like the course of your career and thinking. Tell me a little bit about that in-between space after Pious Fashion came out.
So a big question. And actually, that book, if I look back on it, is really very much a turning point, I think, in my career. So I kind of want to answer that other, the second part of your question, like how has it changed the course of my career? Because I think that it actually has, surprisingly. Before that, you know, I just said I was director of this project that supports public facing work. I never really did any public facing work before Pious Fashion. I avoided it quite successfully for most of my career. And I think because that book was written with a particular tone and style and meant to be something that was more accessible to people outside the academy. I mean, it has an academic argument in it, but it also is conversation and tries to be engaging and also talks about fashion. So like, that's fun. It had a much broader appeal than anything I've written before, which meant I got asked to do a bunch of stuff like podcasts. I never did a podcast before, right? Write op-eds, you know, write something for Teen Vogue, write something for The Atlantic. And that what opened up my eyes, I think, to a new way in which my scholarship could matter in, you know, outside of just like getting me things on my CV to get me tenure and promotion.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think, what else? I think that it's that was actually, that transition was quite frustrating and quite lonely for me. I didn't know how to do it and I couldn't figure out how to do it. And I had to like kind of teach myself and have people who were doing it with me. And so Sacred Rights was also born out of that book in some ways, because Sacred Rights is about creating community to help support scholars who want to do this work. You know, there's some capacity building, like how do you write an op-ed, how do you pitch, but there's also a lot of like conversations about what it means to be doing this work. How do you decide what to say yes and no to? What are the risks, rewards, and responsibilities? So that book, and I think, you know, when we talked, was me just sort of beginning this new, I don't know, I'll make it too grand of a claim, but it's a new chapter in my career, thinking about my vocation slightly differently.
I love it. Well, to me, that book is very accessible, and I've actually excerpted it in some of my own high school teaching.
Oh, really?
As well.
Oh, that's cool to hear.
yeah. And a lot of my students refer to the passages that I have them read in like some of their short answer writing that they do for the course. And so it's a very accessible topic, and it opened up a lot of doors, it sounds like. And, you know, I think that topic is super important because it makes like religion of the world accessible to people who are curious and like well-meaning and open-minded. So I think that's really great to hear that it was such a great turning point in your career. That makes me really happy. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say that I think that I've heard that it works really well in classroom settings, both in college and in high school. But partly the reason why is that, you know, it talks about sort of the meat and potatoes of religious studies, whether or not that's like Orientalism or, you know, religious difference and diversity. But it the way in is something that's very accessible to people. So it kind of tricks them into like getting this religious studies 101 through themes that people can kind of grab onto
Wonderful.
Into their life. Yeah.
Well, your new book, Stealing My Religion, Not Just Any Cultural Appropriation, is coming out again via Harvard University Press. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to chat about this brand new book that is coming to be released in the coming weeks. But by the time this comes out, it will be accessible to people. But you start with a funny story of how the book came to be. And it's humorous and useful because you look at yourself in the mirror a little bit, which is one of my favorite things that writers or songwriters do, is like they kind of like, you know, pick something in the world that people are discussing and then they shine the mirror on themselves. So I would love to hear this origin story of how this book came to be, because it truly had me I was chuckling about it and I thought that it was absolutely wonderful.
So yeah, this wasn't the book I was planning to write next. I have another whole book I have been planning to write for a while that I've been working on. And I had been in Spain. I had just led students in Spain on the Camino again for I think the fourth time, and I was back having a lunch with my editor for Pious Fashion at Harvard University Press, Sharmila Sen. And, you know, she was sort of like, okay, what's next? You know, I was tired and she was, sort of like, let's come up with the next idea. And I was like, okay, well, I don't know what my next book is. I think it's this other book, but first I need to write this article about cultural appropriation because I'm just sort of annoyed about it. I'm annoyed about, not, I mean, not, I'm not like annoyed about the call, the, I guess I'm not annoyed about it, the diagnosis of the problem. Like, I see it as a problem, this sort of like cultural borrowing and grabbing up, and that is, you know, harmful to community, like, so taking credit for or getting financial benefit from something that communities are being exploited for and marginalized for and discriminated against. Like, I see that as a problem. But I just, in the classroom, it was a problem because it was getting sort of rolled out sometimes when we were having hard conversations. Like, and mm-hmm. I'm at my core, I'm a religious ethicist. That's what my PhD from Chicago says on it. And I really think there's a lot of productivity in being in an uncomfortable space when we're talking about morality and values. And so I try to foster that a little bit in my classroom. And so I just found that that was a term that was getting rolled out, and then it was super polarizing, and conversations sort of stopped, and everyone got into their own camps, and I was just like, ugh. And so that was frustrating to me in teaching level. And then also I realized that, like, in terms of popular culture, no one was paying attention to these harmful moments of borrowing that happened with religion. Like, the same people who were like, yeah, awesome, like, or not awesome, Kim Kardashian stopped taking credit for box braids, but then were like totally fine with other cultural phenomenon that felt like sort of grabbing from religion and religious minorities particularly. And so I thought, okay, this, I think what Sharmila said was like, no, this is a book. This is the book I want. Yeah. Like, I don't want an article. But I said, no, it's just an article. She's like, no, it's not an article. It's that's the book. And like on a napkin, we started sketching out case studies. We had like 9 case studies, of which only 3 made it into the book. And I think what I disclose in the preface, which is true, is like when she got to yoga, I was like, oh, wait a minute, what? Okay, now I'm paying attention. Like, I'm kind of like, my research is going to be leaning into this thing that's already been part of my practice and thinking about why it's icky or why it might be problematic and what's the ambiguity around it. And so some of the reasons that draw me to this topic are also the things that I then interrogate throughout the book as things that I'm not so comfortable with by the end of the book. And then I think also starting the book, I realized there was a lot of religious appropriation in my life that I like. I think I'm not a special case. I think it's true for a lot of people. I think that's sort of the way we think about religion in America involves a lot of borrowing, and sometimes it's problematic and sometimes it's not. And I just realized when I was reflecting on it, going back to my Madonna phase in fourth grade, you know, that's when I started wearing crucifix jewelry, not because I'm baptized Catholic, because I'm not practicing. And so, you know, what does that mean that I wore the crucifix necklace that my Catholic grandmother gave me, but only because I was also wearing it with like lace gloves, and, you know, it was sort of a thumbing in my nose at the Catholic Church, not the opposite. And so, you know, it was just really a really interesting topic to think about and reflect on personally and professionally.
I love the Madonna journey, you know, because it ties really closely into your sort of journey out of something that you were born into, it sounds like, right? Am I hitting that right?
I think that's, yeah. I baptized Catholic, raised Protestant, I don't consider myself having a religious affiliation. I'm part of the non-religious affiliated growing majority really in the U.S. now. So that, you know, to pick up religious symbols or even to study religion in some ways is always an act of religious borrowing. So thinking about when is that religious borrowing harmful and when is it not is important for me to think out personally and professionally. And I think, that's sort of why I was like, okay, Sharmila, I'll write this book. I'll do it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into the case studies that you do include. But first, I want to go over just some basic terminology, because I think that's important to break down. So you have the term appropriation, and that matters here because, like, in the preface, you say that students have been using that term to shut down conversations, you know, and instead of engaging in what it really means, like through like mainstream outrage and things like that. But the introduction says, quote, this book focuses on a class of religious borrowings you call religious appropriation, when individuals adopt religious practices without committing to religious doctrines, ethical values, systems or authority or institutions in ways that exacerbate existing systems of structural injustice. So you go on to talk about the importance of harmful ones, and I'm wondering if you can say something about your definition and then go into the difference between harmful religious appropriations and another category you list, borrowings. Can you give us a little breakdown of the terms?
Yeah, let's kind of maybe break down that definition that you just read, which is that's you found it, Greg. That's the definition of religious appropriation in the book. It's sort of like hard to digest it all, you know, when we just say it out loud. The distinction between religious borrowings and religious appropriation is something I actually didn't make till pretty far along in the project, and I realized I had to because all my readers, whenever they saw the word appropriation, they just assumed I was saying it was a negative thing and that it was problematic and that we should stop doing it because we're really conditioned now to think about cultural appropriation as a bad thing. And so I wanted to make space for the fact that sometimes religious borrowings are more neutral. And actually, this is not a book about stop interacting with other religions that aren't your own or stop all religious borrowings. Like, A, that's not possible. It's just religions don't have fixed boundaries. It's just not the way religions work. And B, it might not be ethically beneficial. There are forms of interaction that might look like borrowing that are welcomed by religious communities or individuals or that are important to religious literacy, which I mean not just like, do you know the five pillars of Islam, but do you have sort of a deep understanding of worldviews and value systems. So I've tried to differentiate between borrowings and appropriation. And then the things that are appropriation are the ones that I think are more ethically fraught. But again, like, it's a spectrum. So you kind of have to look at each one in context really carefully. And then if we go back to the definition that you read, partly what I'm looking at is, so that definition talks about how it's when individuals adopt religious practices. So I'm really looking at doing things. Like, when are we like picking up things and like, I'm just going to do this technique and I think I get benefit from this technique, if it's political or health or educational, and I'm basically leaving behind the quote beliefs. I realize I'm doing air quotes right now, which is so unhelpful for a podcast, but like, you know, quote, air quotes beliefs. I'm going to focus more on the practices. And then the first stage to me that sort of raises like a red flag is that the practices are being done while at the same time the community is being rejected or the ethical systems are being rejected or the idea that the institutions of that religious community are bad or the hierarchies or whatever, like all that other stuff. And so that's the idea that you can take out, extract the practice and in some ways be like, this practice is pure if I do it and it's somehow not, you know, impure or it's problematic in these religious communities, so I can actually do it better than these religious communities who do it. So that's the first level of sort of red flag that looking for practices that look like that. And then the other thing is the thing that makes it harmful, which is true for cultural appropriation too, is it's not the borrowing, it's the borrowing within conditions of injustice, right? Mm-hmm. So like, it's problematic when Kim Kardashian wears box braids and people give her credit for creating a particular hairstyle that is, you know, has been popular in the African-American community, for example, but it also is a practice that gets people fired from their job, for example, right? That structural injustice in which the practice and the borrowing happens is what makes it harmful and perhaps offensive. So it turns out that this book was actually about these religious practices, but then if you zoom out, it was a way to see the ways in which different forms of injustice were, you know, interacting, creating conditions where you wanted to borrow, but then also maybe conditions that were harmful conditions, unjust conditions that your borrowing was contributing to that you maybe didn't even know about, didn't weren't even thinking about, right? Like, oh, shoot, darn, I didn't mean to do that, right? So it's sort of like trying to highlight that context.
Yeah. And that can be useful too, because people can do something. And then if you come to understand it in a new way, like we can reduce these kinds of harmful behaviors in the future because people are capable of learning and changing their own behavior when they learn something new that they didn't know before. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think, so that's actually a good transition in the first case study, because that's sort of the takeaway I have from the question of solidarity hijab, like do you do it or do you don't, right? So that's like, solidarity hijab is like the title I'm calling political movements or campaigns that basically tell non-Muslim women to like put on a hijab for a day or a week or whatever, something temporary, as a way to combat gendered Islamophobia. So that's like, okay, I want to combat gendered Islamophobia. That's like a good intent, right? But then when you look more carefully about how, not all, because it's not the same reaction to this practice for the entire Muslim community, but if you look at the reaction by some Muslim women, and the group I'm focusing on particularly are Black Muslim women based in the US at these movements, these solidarity hijab movements, and how they feel like it's tokenizing and centering non-Muslim women in the political conversation and virtue signaling, the ways in which it seems offensive and harmful to them, once you understand that and you understand the way that the hijab functions in the community itself, because it's a contentious practice, and there are some people who don't like there are Muslim women who reject the practice, who would not see a hijab as a good symbol of the tradition either, right? So all these, the more you learn about, the more you'd be like, I don't feel comfortable putting this on anymore. So partly that level of understanding might have you rethink what you're doing, because the actual goals you're trying to reach like are being thwarted by the practice itself, by the interaction with the practice itself.
Oh, interesting. Tell me a little bit about your personal, like, do you have like a cautionary tale of like when you participated in what you call solidarity hijab, and like any like personal experiences you have within that?
Yeah. So, I have worn hijab for field work in conditions where that was expected or legally obligated, for example, in Iran, but that's not quite what I'm talking about. Cause as you know, from that last book, I've spent a lot of time thinking about religious dress and particularly Muslim women's clothing. But I'm thinking more about something like the Women's March, when an image, that iconic image by Shepherd Fairley of a Muslim woman wearing a stylized image of a Muslim woman wearing a flag hijab. When that image came out, was that 2017? Is that right? Yeah, 2017, like right around, you know, it was a protest image against the inauguration of Trump. It was picked up. He had three images, three different sort of minorities that he thought Trump was going to come against. And it was the one that the Women's March really picked up and circulated in a bigger way. And when that first happened, I was like, this is like amazing. Like my secular feminist friends who sort of like are antagonistic to religion have suddenly adopted this religion, this symbol of religion as a symbol of feminist politics, and they thought it was a symbol of intersectionality. And at first I was like, that's cool, and you know, everyone replaced their Facebook page photo with this image. Mm-hmm. Right, it was one of those things, like, you know, my colleagues had a poster printed on the front of her door. I think I might have replaced my, like, you know, Facebook profile. And then it was like, okay, listening to sort of the pushback against that, like, wait a minute, this is like problematizing that, right? So I had already like written a book about Muslim women's fashion at this point, right? But it's again that I think this is a problem, particularly in that chapter, you see the problem with white feminism, like the blind spot to how actions like that are centering a certain idea of what feminist means, so and what is excluded from it. But I think that is a moment where the second case study, right, where we have the New Zealand case, where there, after the Christchurch massacre, there was a big movement to put on a hijab for a day, and as a symbol of solidarity that community. Like, I saw that as a problem. I knew there would be blowback against that. I saw that coming, but I didn't see the first one coming the same kind of way. So that was a learning moment for me as well. I'm not the heroine of this book at all. And so I think that partly showing the mess ups that I make. Again, I am a literal expert in religious ethics. I'm literal expert in these religious traditions. And yet it's still difficult to see the ways in which the things I do are harmful to communities I'm not part of. So me taking you through that self-realization is supposed to open up a conversation for you to have that sort of self-reflection as well.
I love it. Well, I want to move into the second case study here, which is called Playing Pilgrim. Yeah. And you talk about the Camino de Santiago pilgrimage trips. And there's a line that says, a Camino de Santiago pilgrim who describes himself as an atheist. And you talk about how you've been on this pilgrimage a lot of times. And this is a fascinating case study for me, because it's a discussion of how a very powerful religion can also possibly be appropriated. So I'm just curious on this chapter, because this is this was kind of a different one. This one kind of stood out to me.
Yeah. So I created and developed and led a month-long study abroad program in Spain for 5 years. I'm taking a break right now. I haven't decided if I'm going back or not to do it or not. That's part of what this book is me figuring out. And part of that program was to study comparative religion in southern Spain, because there's no better laboratory for like seeing the interaction of Abrahamic religions, for example, which is sort of my bread and butter. And then also always included about a week and a half to 2 weeks walking the Camino, which is a pilgrimage site to where the story tells us the bones of Apostle St. James are buried in the church there. And I think, so this is an interesting case study. You know, it's very different than the other two. They're all very different because it's focused on this, you know, the buzzword now, experiential learning. So what does it mean to have a study abroad program where trying on a religious practice is like core to the curriculum? Like mm-hmm. I always have a couple Catholic students and I sometimes have a handful of Protestant students, but the majority of my students don't have a personal connection to this tradition. And I'm basically like try on being a pilgrim. And they all come because they're like, oh yeah, that's like definitely gonna like change my life, or I'm gonna understand the meaning of life, or I'm gonna like figure out something. But they don't have any intention of like understanding Christianity or Catholicism. They just want to experience this big experience, right? So, I mean, I think that the case study is interesting for me because I do think the Camino is, or I have seen it be a very powerful experience for the, you know, mostly 18-year-olds who like haven't done anything quite so hard maybe in their life, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's physically hard, but it's also emotionally hard. And we're doing full coursework while we're doing it. So it's intellectually challenging. And, you know, everyone cries and everybody hugs. And, you know, so I see that is, and a lot of them talk about it being one of the most important or meaningful experiences of their undergraduate career. But then also balancing it with the fact that like they're like trying to like do pilgrimage right in some authentic way, which they think they can do while rejecting everything about Catholicism or Christianity. And
interesting.
And so it doesn't like does it really create religious understanding, or does it just reinforce this idea that they deserve to take and borrow whatever they want to for their own self-actualization? So that's like a big part of it for me. And the other part of it for me, which I didn't think I realized quite until I started writing this book, is that there's a story about a group that called itself and the other students called God Squad, which was a group of four Protestant students who kind of saw my program as a missionary trip. Mm-hmm. Spent most of the trip trying to explain to everyone on the trip, including me, why Protestantism was sort of like normative Christianity and why Catholicism was like the wrong kind of Christianity. And my interaction with them was really challenging for me and challenging for the class dynamic. But it also really showed me, and I'll let people read that story for themselves, because what they do is sort of like a little bit shocking. But then also I think for myself, it was really helpful to see like what I felt as a leader of this sort of program was problematic. Like I if the idea is that they're supposed to go there and have a crisis of faith, like I don't want to be leading programs that are about having crisis of faith. Like that's not my job.
Right.
But then on the other hand, this program, you know, one thing that I really spent a lot of time talking about, which most people who do the Camino don't talk about, is that there's a history, a religious history in Spain that's erased by the Camino. And partly it's this dark history of how religious minorities are treated by particularly Muslims and Jews, you know, when Christianity becomes dominant again. And so St. James, his nickname in Spanish is Santiago, but his other nickname is Matamoros, Moorkiller. And there's all these statues and things that you walk by when you're on the Camino of like St. James literally crushing the heads of Muslims. And I really center that in our curriculum. So it's again, not a program where you feel like Christians are like the heroes, and that can be really unsettling to students mm-hmm. too, right? So I think it was also an opportunity to think about like, you know, religion is a special sort of subject for students. And so thinking about study abroad programs that have religious practice unpinned from communities or institutions or the students think can be unpinned from communities, institutions is problematic. So that's kind of like my personal takeaway from that chapter.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, the name Matamoros as well is really fascinating, because whenever I used to live in Mexico.
Oh yeah.
And there's a town called Matamoros, yep. very close to the US border. And the first time I came to understand what that translation meant, it was very shocking for me. Very shocking.
Yeah, the Matamoros iconography and like stories were transported when like Spain started to conquer, quote unquote, the New World, right? So you see that there's a lot of towns in South America and the south of the U.S., for example, that have that name, and I don't know that people know where that comes from. I mean, it's, you know, it's, there's this really interesting story about basically, I mean, look, St. James is supposed to be dead already, but he returns to sort of help the Spanish crusaders against the Muslims on a horse, and he's dressed as a medieval knight. And that's who Matamoros is in, you know, if you see a statue. There's one in the Cathedral of Santiago, a pretty gruesome one of like, you know, he's on a white steed, and they're just like Muslims, like being crushed by the hooves of his horse. Mm. And so like, you know, it's important, I think, I really talk a lot to my students about the fact that, like, you know, there's a particular thing going on politically in Spain when this pilgrimage trail is quote unquote discovered and then promoted by the church. And it's a time we're trying to get more Christians into Spain to push the Moors out. And then these stories about St. James, like, so this is not the history itself of the Camino is not unpoliticized or unsullied, right, by politics and sort of bad actors. And I think they want like an experience that's like pure and perfect, and they don't like that, right? But I think that centering that is really important, to know that these experiences and these practices and these traditions are not just about like taking a walk for 2 weeks and like, you know, getting a certificate at the end.
Yeah. Well, let's chat about the third case study. Mm-hmm. I know that yoga is very, you know, important within your own life. And I want to hear the story about, you know, you have a quote in the book that says, a yoga practitioner who insists her practice is merely therapeutic. And so I'm curious about this chapter as well, and this topic, which I know that you care deeply about as well in your own personal life.
Yeah, so I think this chapter for some readers is the hardest because so many people in the US are so devoted to yoga practice. And I think there's this understanding that like when you pick up a practice, even a religious one, for health reasons, like you're totally entitled to do it because we're all able, you know, we should all be able to pursue health no matter what. And so one thing this chapter does is raise the question of like, does your own pursuit of health come at the expense of others, which I think became very clear to us in COVID, during COVID, that it can be, right? You can have live in a community with very low transmission rates or low death rates of COVID, and partly sometimes that comes at the expense of other communities or the US compared to other countries in terms of our vaccinations and things like that. But yeah, so I do have a long history with yoga. I have a mother who learned how to practice yoga in the 70s from PBS and then was a yoga teacher most of my life. And then I practiced for therapeutic reasons for a back injury related to an injury from rowing in college. And but when I say therapeutic reasons, I sort of see that yoga has been in some ways splintered in the US into these two categories where there's like, I call it respite yoga, like sort of therapeutic yoga to feel good, be healthy, look good in a pair of, you know, leggings, fix your back, chill out at the end of the day, whatever. And being very severed from devotional yoga that might have systems of rules, ethical behaviors to follow, understandings of metaphysics or the world, have ties to particularly Eastern religions and communities of practice. And that, so part of this is like a story of the US, like what gets left behind to make yoga as American as apple pie, I think I say at some point, right? Like, what is seen as so foreign, right? So it's like brown bodies, Asian religions, like these things get left behind to make yoga seem more accessible. So that was an interesting chapter. Again, it's a chapter that Sharmila lured me to the project with. And for that chapter, each chapter has primary research, but the one for that was I got certified to teach because I wanted to get an inside look at how one lineage, you know, talked about religion or disclaimed religion. And the lineage I got trained in is one that used to be devotional yoga, used to be, you know, basically an ashram sort of model, like a religious community of devotees that lived in community and just worked in that community and kind of gave up worldly possessions and things like that. And it transitioned to much more respite model or therapeutic model. And now they deny that yoga is religious at all. And so that, again, that's a chapter about, I always get the first question when I talk about this book and this topic, the first question of the audience is usually some undergrad stands up or someone stands up and says, do I have to give up my yoga? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, no, it's not like, my takeaway is not that, but I think it is interesting to think about how that, you know, what practices in different spaces have different ethical implications. So if you're practicing at home versus if you're practicing in a studio, maybe that, you know, only has, doesn't feel comfortable for different bodies, whether those bodies are different sizes or different colors, like are you contributing to that maintenance of ableism or whiteness? So thinking about the spaces that you practice in is part of it. And I think, you know, also thinking about what's pulling you towards it. And is there something, you know, if you like Pilates better than, you like yoga better than Pilates, is there something pseudo-religious about it that you like? And, but at the same time, are you judgmental of the religious traditions that, you know, have inspired this? Yoga is much bigger than just the practices that are so popular now, but they come out of these larger devotional communities. And then I think, you know, if the solidary hijab chapter is really about, you know, the more you learn, sometimes the more you'll pull back and not want to do things. The yoga chapter and the conclusion are a little bit more like the more you learn, you might be doing religion. Like you might just start religioning, right? You might find that you actually, the devotional thing, like, so just know, these are like serious practices. You might, and there's a lot of people I went through training with, for example, who have a very serious yoga practice. And I, even if they wouldn't, some of them would adopt the world religion, some of them wouldn't, but it does, the ideas and the ethics and the metaphysics, the stuff, the beliefs behind it that you thought you weren't engaging with because the practices were safe to do. You might start to like, they might start to be internalized, right? And so I think that's another takeaway from the book, that these things, if you're Mallory Nye, who is an independent scholar, has this great line, like if religion is a verb, not a noun. So if you are doing the things, you're religioning. So it may be that doing these practices means you're actually engaged in religion more than you think you are.
I mean, I actually have a personal example of that too. You know, there's a big movement in Zen to just talk about how it's like not a religion and things like that. And whenever I moved to Buffalo, I went to a couple of sittings with the local Zen group here, and there's a lot of liturgy that goes on. Mm-hmm. And then they did start describing it as a religion, but I was like talking about it back in Missouri with a Rinzai person who was like, yeah, this isn't really religious. But then the people in Buffalo were like, yes, this is religious. So I've actually experienced that kind of careening between the religious versus not religious. And that was always very confusing for me. And I think that kind of disoriented me as well, because I was like leaning towards the not religious part, but then I got like, you know, I fell in with this group who says it was religious, and I think it confused me so much that I bailed on it.
Yeah. So I think that distinction between like respite and devotional, therapeutic and religious, is you see also in meditation, sort of just generally in its popularity. And, you know, there's something about like, well, what is the community that you're part of, say? But then I think there's also something, again, that self-reflective, like what's at stake with you about rejecting or accepting that something can be religious or not? And that means that this book is a question about like what counts as religion and what, you know, how do we think about religion, particularly in the American setting? There's something appropriation happens everywhere, but there's something particularly American about the idea that like religion is part of the salad bar of life. And if I want to like pick and choose and mix them together because of, again, politics, education, health, those are the three big themes in the book, I am entitled to do so. And I don't want to shut that down, but I also want to be like, okay, but also, what are there implications? Are there effects on people that you haven't thought through? And does knowing those effects change your sort of approach to doing this?
I'm curious about when you and Sharmila were laying out a possible pathway for this book, what other case studies were you thinking of that didn't get in? You don't have to tell me all of them, but if there are some that really stand out, I'm definitely curious to hear more if there were some that you were, you know, thinking about examining in the future.
Yeah. So the one that I just spoke to some colleagues about that almost made it in was circumcision. And again, a really different kind of case study, but also a very American case study, where male circumcision is very popular in the US around within communities that it's not a religious practice for, right? So within non-Jewish or non-Muslim communities, and the way in which the American Association of Pediatrics deals with it here is very different than the way that other pediatric associations deal with it in other countries. And so again, I think it's just it's a space to think about how religion has sort of trickled into American culture in some ways that we sometimes aren't aware of. That one's interesting. And that one's a particularly interesting case study for me. And I teach that one a lot because of the way the American Association of Pediatrics deals very different with male and female cutting. And I think in the US, we have an understanding of like female cutting is this extreme practice, even though there's a whole range of things and it's, you know, and it's illegal, versus male cutting is just what we do. And depending on what family you're in, even if you don't have religious reasons for it, just like a normal penis looks like this. And so that is something that really works well in my classes. So it didn't, that and other case studies didn't make it in the book for one or two reasons. I wanted to make sure that I could be autoethnographic. So I wanted to be able to share, I wanted to be able to share stories of my own experience. And I have a daughter, right? So this is not a thing that I had to think about and make decisions about in terms of circumcision with my partner. So my partner is Jewish. My family is not. It would have been a super interesting dilemma, I think, for us to deal with, but it wasn't one that I had a personal story about, so it didn't make it into the book for that, for this particular book. Although I think intellectually it's an interesting case study, and it's very, very, like, there's just like a lot of different players involved and a lot of people have a lot of stake in that. So I was going to be do it, it would be other people's stories that would really animate it, and I was worried it would come across as judgy compared to these other stories. And then other things didn't make it in because maybe I had a personal connection but not one that I felt like, you know, I could share in public. So really, that's a question. Like, this is one of those calculuses you do as a writer about, you know, what parts of yourself do you want to share to start a conversation, and what parts do you like not want to share? So I think I'm the most vulnerable, probably. I actually am pretty vulnerable in all the chapters.
Yeah, you are. It's really an impressive part of the book, how open and honest you are. But like I said, about like shining the mirror on yourself to kind of like get the conversation going. It's really fabulous.
Yeah. I mean, I think the yoga one was the hardest one for me to write, because I do have a practice, and think writing this book made me think about how it bleeds into devotional practice in a way as I hadn't before. But yeah, I mean, there were like, I can't remember all the case studies. I just think, you know, there were just so many ways in which religion is part of popular culture. I mean, there's a whole thing now with like satyrs and you know, you pick any religious practice, and then you can find, you know, something that is picked, that is communities outside that, outside communities or outsiders pick up that practice and like, oh, if that's beneficial to you as religious practice, maybe it's beneficial to me in some ways.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, before we conclude this conversation, if you have any updates you'd like to talk about sacred rites at all, if there's any like kind of, you know, comprehensive report or, you know, comments that you have for the audience.
Comprehensive report. Okay. Yeah. So I just got back. We're recording when I've just returned from a retreat that was a joint project with Sacred Rites and the Forum for Theological Exploration. So we did a retreat on writing as vocation for a cohort of doctoral students of color. And that was really, really great because the retreat was not only public writing, but just thinking about scholars as writers and what, you know, if I had thought of myself as a writer before, I only started thinking of myself as a writer since Pious Fashion, really, since my book before this book. And I think if I had thought about myself as a writer before, I wonder what that would have meant in terms of not only what I would have written or how I've written, but how my relationship to writing and how I might have found it more energizing and sustainable and less, you know, exhausting. So that's part of doing these collaborations has been part of the work. We also have, we just recently got two new grants to support another four or five rounds of training. Actually, I'm really excited around a couple cohorts focused on scholars who work on the intersection of race, religion, and justice. And those are supported by the Luce Foundation. And another cohort focused on scholars who are working on sexuality and sexual difference. And that one is sponsored by the Carpenter Center. So we are, we've just spent, Greg, you've been part of this. We've just spent the last 9 months doing a whole curriculum review. Like, we taught our curriculum for 3.5 years, and we wanted to do sort of a review, particularly around being more conscious about our sort of anti-racist mission. And so we sort of did an anti-racist revamp of the curriculum with focus groups and revisions, everything. And we just reproduced everything. And Greg was so kind to come on board and help us with the editing of these, the audio parts of we have these podcast versions of our lessons that we'll do on online training. So yeah, we have a lot of things going on. So stay tuned for follow Sacred Rights on Twitter. And we, particularly if you're interested in trainings, keep your eyes open, because those are free and sometimes even come with a stipend to participate. And it can be great for finding community to do this kind of work.
Well, Dr. Liz Bukar, where can people find you if they want to follow along and know more about your work?
So my Twitter handle is one place to start. So that's at Bukar Liz. And I also have a website that's actually just relaunched for this book, which is fun. And that's a place to see where any media coverage I have. I'll try to keep that up to date. And also my upcoming talks for the fall. I'm doing quite a bit of talks around the book release, for example. So those will all be updated there as well. And that's lizbukar.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a real pleasure to chat about your brand new book, Stealing My Religion, Not Just Any Cultural Appropriation, coming from Harvard University Press. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Greg. It's always great to talk to you.